succession of verbal utterances that had an effect on the world. At first sight, this is not particularly surprising. All language users utter words and sentences with the expectation that this may have an effect on the world. But for most language users, this effect comes about through the intermediary of those who hear and understand their words and sentences. We can order or request others to do something, or influence others to act and behave in accordance with our wishes by means of verbal messages. This was not the way Brahmins believed their sacred formulas to affect the world. Sacred formulas, mantras is the Indian term, were believed to affect the world without the intermediary of other beings, whether human or non-human or divine. Mantras affect the world directly on condition that they are correctly pronounced in the right circumstances, of course. This efficacy of the mantras is at least in part due to their language. This language is the one that came to be called Sanskrit, but which early Brahmanical users and thinkers merely considered the correct use of words. Underlying the Brahmin's ritual activity is the conviction that Sanskrit can have a direct effect on the world. This because Sanskrit and reality are related in ways other languages are not. These other languages, you will understand, were looked upon as incorrect use of words. Brahmanical myths even explain that the world has been created in accordance with the words of the Veda. The Veda, then, is a corpus of texts containing mantras that have an effect on the world without the intermediary of a hearer. For many Brahmins, the Vedic mantras, and more generally the whole Veda, have no initial speaker either. The Veda has no author and is therefore pure self-existent speech. Having no author implies that it has no beginning in time. The Veda is therefore beginningless, eternal speech. Being pure speech, not soiled by the interference of an author, who may conceivably be ill-informed or ill-intentioned, not being affected by an intermediary person, the statements and injunctions of the Veda cannot but be reliable, if only we can interpret them objectively. This belief is behind the need felt to develop a method to find an objective interpretation of the Veda. Reflections about the interpretation of Sanskrit sentences in general did not lag behind and continued until recent times. Let us return for a moment to the centrality of Sanskrit in Brahmanical linguistic thought. This belief is so fundamental that it is easily overlooked in modern scholarship. It influenced all Brahmanical thought about language and about much else. As a matter of fact, languages other than Sanskrit were rarely, if ever, taken into consideration by Brahmanical thinkers. Their linguistic thought concerned a privileged language, from their point of view, the only correct language. The only language also that has a natural and intimate link with reality. One exaggerates but little when stating that much of Brahmanical thought is an inquiry into the consequences of this belief. Unlike Brahmanism, Buddhism did not start out with any identifiable implicit or explicit convictions about language. The message of the Buddha was spread in local languages, being adjusted or translated where necessary. Language did come to play an important role in Buddhist thought, but not until a few centuries after the death of the Buddha, and initially in a region far removed from the region where he had preached. This region is called Gandhara, and in fact is nowadays part of Pakistan and borders on what is nowadays called Afghanistan. Gandhara, this region, witnessed a thorough rethinking of Buddhist teaching. This happened probably already in the second century before the Common Era. The Buddha died, just to give an impression, around the year 400 before the Common Era. The philosophy created by these Buddhists in northwestern India, or the northwestern part of the Indian subcontinent, this philosophy saw the world as essentially atomic and momentary in nature, as being constituted of ultimate momentary constituents called dharmas. The word dharma you may know in another meaning. Dharma has many meanings. These Buddhists use the term dharma to designate the ultimate constituents of what there is. This philosophy went one step further and looked upon these dharmas as the only really existing things. So what we see in our life, this desk and you persons, you are accumulations of dharmas, but only the dharmas really exist. The accumulations, the things made up of dharmas, which includes all things we are acquainted with, such as chariots, houses, persons, and so on, they are not dharmas themselves, and therefore they do not really exist. So far, language plays no role in the philosophical vision elaborated by the Buddhist scholiasts of northwestern India. You notice when I say India, I mean the Indian subcontinent, because in fact it is nowadays would be called Pakistan. Let's be clear about this. Language does play a role in explaining that we believe that we live in a world of chariots, houses, and much else that does not really exist. So you see, that's their problem. They come to the conclusion that all the say, macroscopic things that fill our daily life do not really exist. Then why do we think they exist? Now, all these ultimately non-existing things are nothing but words. This is a theme that comes up in this philosophy and is repeated many times over in the Buddhist texts. Stated differently, we are tricked by language into thinking that we live in a world populated by objects that do not really exist. The Buddhist philosophy of northwestern India spread in subsequent centuries all over the subcontinent and beyond, and underwent many developments. However, the conviction that we live in an unreal world and that this unreal world has a close link with language remained a characteristic of Buddhist thought. In fact, subsequent Buddhist thinkers made a further claim that not even dharmas exist. So these ultimate constituent parts, the only things that really existed according to the scholiasts I mentioned, even those at some point are being rejected by later thinkers as non-existent. Clearly, this left those Buddhists in an ultimately non-existing world and a world of ordinary experience created by language. It follows from what I've said that Brahmanical and Buddhist thinkers, though starting from altogether different positions, and without influencing each other during the early period, arrived at a very similar conclusion. Both now believed that there was an intimate link between the world of our experience and language. Both accepted, each in their own way, that our common sense world had been created by language. There were important differences, of course. Brahmanical thinkers thought that language was close to the real world, and Buddhists thought that it was close to the ultimately unreal, imaginary world of our experience. Brahmins did not talk about language in general, but only about Sanskrit, for them, the only real language. Buddhist thinkers did not privilege one language, at least not initially. Brahmanical and Buddhist thinkers came to interact in subsequent centuries. This led to a refinement of their positions and sometimes to large-scale borrowing in both directions. The Buddhist notion of the unreality of our common sense world did not initially agree with Brahmanical conceptions of the world. However, roughly from the middle of the first millennium of the Common Era, say 500 or thereabouts, from that time onward, this notion, the notion that the world of our experience is not ultimately real, came to find favor with at least some Brahmanical thinkers who adjusted it to their needs. In doing so, they also reserved a place for language, the Sanskrit language, of course, which had to play a role here too to explain our common sense world. The conviction that language and reality are closely connected profoundly influenced the philosophies that Brahmanism and Buddhism developed over time. It also had an effect on the kind of arguments they considered coherent. And now we get to the topic of our conference, logic and reasoning. I will consider two kinds of arguments. In one of these, the claim is made that something exists because there is a word for it. This kind of argument might convince Brahmins, but would not convince Buddhists, for reasons that I explained earlier. Brahmanism took the close connection between words and really existing things for granted, whereas Buddhism looked upon things designated by words as not really existing. The second kind of argument that I will turn to is slightly more subtle. It claims that statements refer to situations constituted of the things designated by the words of that statement. This complicated sentence, we come back to it, you'll get my point. This kind of argument became central to all schools of Indian philosophy, Brahmanical, Buddhist, and even also Jaina schools of philosophy. I will be brief about the first point. The first point I made is that in the Brahmanical world, people thought something for which there is a word must therefore exist. Now, this at first sight may strike you as bizarre. In English, it might be illustrated by claims such as angels exist because the word angel is there. Other example, Martians exist because there is the word Martian. In English, such an argument would carry no weight whatsoever because words are arbitrary. We can create words for anything we imagine, existing or non-existing. However, this comparison with English reminds us to be careful not to impose our cultural prejudices on a different culture. The words of Sanskrit are not arbitrary, at least for Brahmins. And it is not possible to create new words in this language. The Brahmanical position is that Sanskrit has been in existence from beginningless time and cannot be changed. The argument that something must exist because there is a word for it is not therefore as ridiculous as it looks at first sight. Now, a number of early classical Sanskrit works shows that this argument was indeed used by certain thinkers, usually in discussions that involve words such as heaven or deity, words that refer to entities that cannot be observed. Early Indian thinkers, most of them apparently belonging to the school of Vedic interpretation, called Mimamsa, for the specialists among you, those thinkers accepted that the very existence of these words guaranteed that the objects denoted, heaven and deity respectively, exist. Now, I will be brief about this because this kind of argument disappeared relatively soon from the literature for an interesting reason, actually for a largely sociological reason. The interpreters of the Veda, they were inclined to think that words have to correspond to corresponding entities. They lived through a period in which temple worship made its appearance, and a number of Brahmins who were looked down upon, started making a living offering gifts to the gods. The most orthodox Brahmins, they didn't like that at all. That was a development they were against. Vedic Brahmanism had no temples, had no image worship, had none of the kind, and they hated to see that some of their so-called fellow Brahmins made a living on the back of people who gave their money to them rather than to the orthodox Brahmins. And so there's a whole discussion which takes a very intellectual form, and in which it is argued, these gods that you claim to worship, they don't even exist. The argument that the word deity proves that those gods exist had to be abandoned, and with that, the first argument I mentioned, words have to correspond to entities, slowly disappeared in the dustbin. So I will not insist on this part and turn to the next argument I promised I would talk about. What was the second argument? They are arguments based on the conviction that statements refer to situations constituted of the things designated by the words of that statement. Now, I think I give an example, otherwise it's hard to catch. If we say, I stand at the desk, whatever, then this statement describes a situation in which there is I could describe someone else, Mr. Johnson stands at a desk, in which there is Mr. Johnson, there is a desk, and there is this activity of standing, whatever its ontological status. But these three things, and in Sanskrit, of course, there are no articles, so there's no the, and there are case endings, so there is no in or on. The words of the statement correspond one by one to the items in the situation described. To some extent, this is common sense, but if you take this belief too literally, you can get into serious trouble. And all Indian thinkers of the period took this belief very seriously. They believed in what I call the correspondence principle. That means words of a statement corresponds to items in the situation described. So if I say the cat sits on the mat, forget the articles, forget the on. In Sanskrit it's just cat sits mat. Then there are three things there, a cat, a mat, and the sitting. However, as I said, problems arise in statements that are about the production of something or about something coming into being. consider the statement, the potter makes a pot. This statement refers to a situation in which there is a potter and there is the act of making, but there is no pot in that situation. If there were a pot in that situation, the potter would not have to make it, right? So the potter makes a pot if you really want to stick to the correspondence principle, ends you in serious trouble. Now, statements like these, like this one, were experienced as problematic. And I repeat, by all Indian thinkers of the period concerned. They also came to be used as arguments. Now, I will read with you a few lines, and they will appear, if this works, right. Some lines from a text. It's a Buddhist text from probably the 3rd century of the Common Era. I read it with you. If there existed anywhere something unarisen, it could arise. Now think of the potter makes the pot. If this pot were there, the potter could make it. Since no such thing exists, what is it that arises? What is it that the potter makes? The production of something that exists already is not possible. You don't need to make a pot that is already there. The production of something that does not exist is not possible either. Nor is there production of something that both exists and does not exist. Of course, the middle part here, you see the presupposition. The production of something that does not exist is not possible. Why should it not be possible? The potter can make a pot that doesn't exist. If you seriously believe in the correspondence principle, the pot has to be there for the statement to make sense at all. The destruction of an existing entity is not possible. I won't comment on every single line because you see that a similar kind of reflection comes up again and again. The destruction of a non-existent entity is not possible either. So these are lines from a text, the Mulamadhyamaka Karika by Nagarjuna. These lines are taken from that work. To understand them, we must think of the potter who makes a pot. The statement implies, for those who accept the correspondence principle, that there is a pot in the situation referred to by the potter makes a pot. But since the pot is still to be made, it is a pot that does not yet exist. This is how Nagarjuna can say, if there existed anywhere something unarisen, that's the first line, it could arise since no such thing exists. What is it that arises? The other lines make sense for similar reasons. As I pointed out earlier, these at first sight contradictory observations are used as arguments. They are meant to show that the world of our experience does not exist, indeed cannot exist. It cannot exist because much of what we say about it is self-contradictory. But as long as one is not aware of the importance of the correspondence principle in Indian thought, these lines do not look like arguments, but rather like gobbledygook. And even though these lines do not refer to language at all, the word language or word does not occur in these lines, the presupposition on which they are based have everything to do with language, for the correspondence principle is about the relationship between language and reality. Nagarjuna was a Buddhist. Like other Buddhists, he believed that the world of our experience is a creation of language, not ultimately real. The contradictions he brought to light did, in the end, only confirm the Buddhist worldview. He was certainly recognized as an original thinker among his fellow Buddhists, but these fellow Buddhists did not have to completely refashion their worldview under the weight of his arguments. You see, Buddhists had already maintained for several centuries that the world of our daily experience doesn't really exist. If Nagarjuna proves that, well, so much the better, so to say. The situation was far less comfortable for the Brahmanical and Jaina thinkers. They too implicitly accepted the correspondence principle. So they too find a statement like "the potter makes the pot" problematic. More problematic than the Buddhists, for unlike the Buddhists, they did not deny the reality of the phenomenal world. What could they do? They were really in trouble, so to say. Interestingly, since they could not abandon the correspondence principle, they used such problematic statements to prove visions of reality which they appear to have invented for the occasion. Consider the Brahmanical school known by the name Sankhya. One of its classical texts is called Verses on Sankhya. Sankhya Karika. This contains the following line, you have it projected. The effect pre-exists in the cause because one cannot make what does not exist. You see, the same old question, how can the potter make a pot if there is no pot? No, the answer that Sankhya provides is the effect, the pot, pre-exists in the cause, that is the material cause, that means in the mud that, potter uses to make the pot. Now, I hope you recognize the situation. The potter can only make a pot if the pot exists, because one cannot make what does not exist. We have seen that. That was an argument. And what does this prove? It proves that the effect pre-exists in the cause. This is the conclusion the Sankhya philosophers draw from this problematic situation. In concrete terms, this means the pot exists already in the clay out of which it will be fashioned. This is a doctrine called, in Sanskrit, Sat Karya Vada, which means no more than that the doctrine that which claims that the effect is already existent in its cause. It became a cornerstone of the Sankhya philosophy. It is not likely to convince many modern readers, but this is because the supporting argument is lost on those modern readers. For us, at first sight, it's a rather bizarre theory, and you wonder why the hell should anyone believe that? Modern readers do not swear by the correspondence principle the way many Indian thinkers did. Those who do, whether implicitly or explicitly, will appreciate the argument much better. The potter can only make a pot if there is one, if there is a pot. And where is that pot then? In the clay from which it will be formed. This Sat Karya Vada, the doctrine that the effect exists already in the material cause, was not limited to Sankhya. The same position is taken in a work by Shankara. Shankara is perhaps the most famous classical Indian philosopher. He is the central author of so-called Advaita Vedanta. Many, many modern Indians follow his philosophy as part of their religious beliefs, if that's what the term is. I quote a passage from one of his works, the Brahma Sutra Bhashya, which I read it with you. If the effect did not exist prior to its coming into being, the coming into being would be without agent and empty. So if I say the pot comes into being, that describes a situation in which there is no pot. That means this statement has no agent and is therefore empty. For coming into being is an activity and must therefore have an agent. Like activities such as going. If I say Mr. Johnson goes to America, then of course there is a Mr. Johnson. If there is no Mr. Johnson, then the whole statement becomes empty. It would be contradictory, it would be contradictory to say that something is an activity but has no agent. There are no activities without agent. It could be thought that the coming into being of a pot, though mentioned, would not have the pot as agent, but rather something else. Because in the situation where a pot is being made, there are other things that are present, like the potter. If that were true, one would say the potter and other causes come into being, right? Coming into being needs an agent, so take something in from the situation, and you say the potter comes into being. But this does not describe what we want to say. We would say that instead of the pot comes into being. In the world, however, when one says the pot comes into being, no one understands that, also the potter, etc., come into being. For these are understood to have already come into being. They have been there for a long time, and it's only the pot that comes into being. Now, this may, again, at first sight, look like gobbledygook. It isn't really. Once you try to share this view of what I call the correspondence principle, this makes perfect sense. There is a real problem here. This passage, and the underlined passage in particular, show the close link between the Satkaryavada, which I mentioned earlier, and language in Shankara's mind. Because in this passage, the link with language is made explicit. This is what we say, and therefore this must be the case. Other Brahmanical thinkers were willing to use the apparent contradiction to draw even more daring conclusions. One text, called The Science of Tradition, Agama Shastra, whose author is really unknown, people say he was called Gaudapada, but we don't know a thing about him, it has the following to say. In their debates with one another, some teachers maintain the arising of what exists. Other intelligent ones maintain the arising of what does not exist. Of course, we now already know the Sankhya, which I mentioned earlier, would say the pot arises, the pot comes into being, because it exists already in the clay. Others say, no, something new comes into existence. I haven't elaborated that point here, but this is what Gaudapada says. So other intelligent teachers maintain the arising of what does not exist. Nothing that exists can arise. What does not exist cannot arise either. Arguing thus, followers of non-duality teach non-arising. So the author of this text, he says, nothing ever comes into being. That means he is willing to abandon ordinary reality in which things change and come into being and say, no, that's only fantasy, nothing comes into being. And on what basis, what is his argument? Essentially, sentences as simple as the potter makes a pot. In ultimate truth, nothing arises. I won't read the other lines right now. The end, the birth of something existent is possible through illusion, but not in reality. For someone who thinks that something arises in reality, it is an arisen thing that arises. The birth of something non-existent is possible neither through illusion nor in reality. the son of a barren woman is born neither in truth nor through illusion. You see the comparison? A barren woman has no son. So if you want to know how the son of a barren woman comes into being, how he arises, he isn't born neither in truth nor through illusion. Now, the last few authors we have considered were Brahmanical authors. Brahmanism, I pointed out earlier, distinguished themselves, or Brahmins distinguished themselves from Buddhists, in that its thinkers, unlike the Buddhists, accepted the reality of the world of our experience. Brahmanism for a long time was wedded to the idea that the world we live in is real and corresponds to the words of the Sanskrit language. This observation now had to be modified. Certain Brahmanical thinkers, who in the course of time became numerous, came to accept that the world of our experience is not real after all. So they gave in to the position that Buddhists had presented for centuries. The idea that phenomenal reality is ultimately an illusion gained in importance and, in the long run, became predominant. One might think that Buddhist influence played a role here. And there may be a grain of truth in this. But as important, if not more so, was the felt strength of the argument based on the supposed contradictory nature of phenomenal reality. Analysis based on the correspondence principle shows that things cannot come into being. So apparently they do not come into being. An argument based on an implicit presupposition totally overturned the philosophical worldview of many Brahmins. There were, to be sure, Brahmanical schools of thought that resisted this development. They looked for and found arguments to maintain that ordinary reality is not just an illusion. I cannot consider these arguments at present. I don't want to overburden you, and perhaps there isn't so much time left. I do, however, invite you to briefly look at the way Jaina thinkers dealt with the problem. You remember the third group of thinkers I mentioned, besides Brahmins, Buddhist, was the Jainas, followers of Jainism as a religion. Jainism adopted a position according to which reality is manifold, a position they call anekantavada, but forget that term if it means nothing to you. Reality is manifold. I will read with you a passage from a Jaina text, the special commentary on the Avashyaka Sutra. And first, the first passage is the voice of an opponent. There we go. What has been produced is not being produced because it is already there, like a pot. But if you accept that also that which has been produced is being produced, you will have infinite regress. What has not been produced is not being produced either, because it is not there, like the horn of a donkey. And if you accept that also that which has not been produced is being produced, you will have to accept that non-entities, such as the horn of a donkey, etc., can be produced. The horn of a donkey, of course, donkeys don't have horns. That's why it's a favorite example. The horn of a donkey is something that really, really does not exist. And these horns, they don't come into being, they don't disappear, because they are simply not there. That which has been both produced and not produced is not produced either, because the problems bound up with both positions would accrue. Now, this is a little repetition of the problem which you now are familiar with, the problem of how can something come into existence if, I add, if you believe you hold on to the correspondence principle. This position is subsequently criticized. The following passage clarifies the position of the author. In this world, there are things that are being produced, having been produced already. Others are being produced, not having been produced already. Others are being produced, having been produced, and not having been produced. Others, again, are being produced while being produced. And some are not being produced at all, according to what one wishes to express. For example, a pot is being produced, having been produced in the form of clay. Now we recognize here this position of Sankhya. The pot is in the clay. The Jainas, they accept that, but only partially. That's part of the truth. So a pot is being produced in the form of clay, because it is made of that. That same pot is being produced, not having been produced, concerning its particular shape, because that was not there before. The clay did not yet have the shape of a pot. The pot is produced, having been produced and not produced at the same time, with respect to its color, etc., and its specific form, because it is not different from these things. It is produced while being produced, because, so it goes on a bit like that, becomes a little bit boring, but it analyzes the situation in a way, and if you wonder, what do they want? What do these guys want with all this complicated reasoning? And I give you the answer, to get around the consequences of a shared belief, namely in the correspondence principle. This, the beginning of this passage, gives expression to the anekantavada, the multiple nature of reality, in at least one of its usual forms. I will not repeat that. Reality is manifold, and this solves the problem of the potter and his pot. Well, to conclude, the humble village potter may not have been aware to what extent his activity shook Indian philosophy or Indian theology in its foundations. The argument it gave rise to was unanswerable to many Indian thinkers unless they thoroughly revised their ontology. This is what they did, and the result is well known. For many nowadays, Indian philosophy is synonymous with the rejection of ordinary reality as illusory. It was not always like that, and not all are disturbed by it. The Indian village potter continues to ply his trade, whatever philosophers and theologians may say about it. Thank you very much.